Dabble, Bubble, Knips and Gobble, Eye of Spanner and Foot of House, with this potion brew make trouble, turn this boy into a mouse.
No, you can't do this. I don't want to be a mouse. I'm allergic to cheese. My name's Maki Yamazaki, and you're listening to Still Scared, a podcast about children's horror. And today, witches.
Hello, Adam, and hello, Alex.
Hello.
Hello.
great to have you back. Last episode of Over the Garden Wall was really good, and I think quite well listened to.
Oh dear.
So no pressure. We like having you here. It's good.
with all your many friends to listen.
Yeah.
I did ask for feedback on Twitter about whether I was awful, and nobody responded. So they may have all listened and thought I was terrible.
They were lost for words for how informative and interesting you were, definitely.
You were particularly interested in today's topic, which is The Witches by Roald Dahl.
It's one of those things that I actually remember from being a kid. Even if mostly I remember, rather than it being horror, I just remember like really wanting to be a mouse.
It's a sort of aspirational text.
Yeah, no, I mean, the book really, really sells it as an idea that it would actually just be really, really lovely and you could just have a lot of fun. You're not going to live that long, but, you know, at least you get to kind of like sneak around and have weird contraptions built for you by your lovely grandmama.
Yeah.
I don't think I got that far. Like, I don't think I got far enough to get to the life's great as a mouse bits. For me, this was one of the cursed books of childhood. Like, I couldn't even sleep in the same room as it. I remember going around, staying over at parents' friends, and their kid had a copy of The Witches on the bookshelf, and I think I had to ask my dad to come and remove the book. I didn't even want to handle it myself. So I think I only read the first few chapters as a kid, but I do remember watching the film and that also being terrifying.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't think I read it as a kid because I think I had it read to me in class. But I'm pretty sure that I didn't read it because the illustrations are just so horrific that I those would have been seared into my memory if I'd have seen those as a kid. So I'm pretty sure I didn't read it.
Yeah, it's funny because I really struggled with Quentin Blake's illustrative style as a kid. I think it was a slightly obsessive thing, but I found the kind of prickly scritchiness of it all, like the sheer messiness of his style, to be really off-putting, whereas now I really appreciate it. I love how expressive it is. But as a kid, I really didn't like Quentin Blake's drawings. I found them quite viscerally upsetting. Not just The Witches, in general, just his drawing style. The bristliness or something, like the twits as well. I remember the drawings being very upsetting. Yeah. Whereas, yeah, I really like it now. Like, there's a newish museum in London called the House of Illustration, which exhibits the work of different illustrators. And I'm really hoping there'll be an exhibition on Quentin Blake. Maybe a joint one of Quentin Blake and Shirley Hughes. Oh, I'd love to go to that. Mm.
Yeah.
Did you watch the film as a kid?
Yeah, I did. I saw it at a friend's house and I literally hid behind the sofa. It's the only time I actually remember doing that. But I sort of remember the beginning of the film quite clearly, and then after that I was clearly hiding for quite significant portions of it.
Your memory is filled with the back of the sofa.
Yeah. What about you, Alex? Did you watch it?
I'm pretty sure that I watched it, although, again, my predominant memory is of the, like, weird machines built around the house. Like, I think I just really, like, I don't know if I was... It's weird, because I think I was a very, very scared child, but I didn't read a lot of horror, but the horror that I read, I don't think I was actually that scared by. It was always really odd things that I was scared by. The book that I was terrified of was, I think I told Ren this, was... Just the cover was enough to unsettle me. Like, I definitely never read it as a child, but I was absolutely horrified by my brother's copy of A Clockwork Orange. because the cover was just this very immaculate, simple, pastel, abstract vision of this person with a cog instead of an eye and a top hat. And that was horrific. Like, I remember hiding that book. I remember running away from that book. But yeah, no, The Witches was just, it was just a romp, you know. I think I always thought of Roald Dahl stuff as just being like these, they're fantastical in that way where they see things from a kid's perspective, and then even when they're awful, it's just like, oh yeah, that's just kind of how the world is. The world's awful, didn't you know? Like, and yeah, I don't know. I appreciated that.
That's interesting, because if you look at the genre classification of the film on IMDb, it's classified as a mystery adventure film. Mm. Was my immediate feeling was, what? This is a horror film. But clearly you did experience it as an adventure film.
Yeah, I think that might be how I cope with things that are horrific, is just thinking of them as a jolly good romp.
So I think it makes sense, Adam, that you bailed on the book after the first couple of chapters as a kid, because I think the horror is quite front-loaded in The Witches.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, it really gets in with it straight away. Because we start with the unnamed protagonist is... staying with his grandmother, and she's teaching him how to recognize witches. So the first couple of chapters are about how to recognize a witch, and then the grandmother's horrible tales about things that have happened to children at the hands of witches.
Yeah, and it strikes up a very authoritative tone, how Blair Witch Project or Texas Chainsaw Massacre start with their front-ended documentary style sequences. This is very insistent that it's not a fairy tale, it is about, capital letters, real witches.
Mm-hmm.
And real witches dress in ordinary clothes and look very much like ordinary women. They live in ordinary houses and they work in ordinary jobs. It struck me that the rhetoric around witches here is very similar to the rhetoric used sometimes quite crassly about psychopaths.
Mm-hmm.
The readings say John Ronson's The Psychopath Test. You know, the experts on psychopaths really stress this idea of they look like you and me, but they're not the same as you and me. Which, you know, I think is somewhat overstressed, you know, often, you know, by people who aren't don't have clinical knowledge. But it struck me that the recurrent rhetoric around the witches in the book is very similar to this. That, yeah, you know.
I mean, it's very abhorrent othering in a lot of ways. Like, you know, it's not a pleasant thing if you in any way try and think of the people being described as being people and not like the embodiment of pure evil. Which is kind of gets away with being okay in this sort of situation, but also has like, yeah, an unpleasantness to it that I don't know if we can get away from.
Yeah, I think actually the film redeems it somewhat, because apart from Angelica Houston's portrayal of the Grand High Witch, the witches seem a lot more just sort of creaturely than humans. They're these sort of chittering, ratty little creatures. They never seem particularly like they're meant to be women. to me, at least in the film. Whereas I feel that's less the case in the book.
It's interesting, though, because then, like, that was one of my problems with the film, which I know you want to talk about later, but, like, the fact that the potential for redemption for witches is one of those things that kind of goes against that and actually makes it, I don't know, it sticks with me a little bit in terms of, like, such a black and white morality that it presents, that at the same time, if someone's capable of just for no explicit reason changing, then is it really okay to go on a 9-year scheme in which you're going to attempt to annihilate every single one of this group?
That's a really good point, actually. Yeah. We'll get onto that later. But yeah, normally people will talk about redemption being inserted into a narrative as kind of complicating the black and white morality, you know, that. But I see what you're saying, but here, actually, it's potentially very problematic that redemption's introduced, because suddenly the witches become a lot more humanised, and then we might start mapping out onto the real world. And certainly as a kid, you know, I do remember, after having read the first few chapters, you know, eyeing women on the street suspiciously. You know, I had a teacher at school who was particularly mean to me, and I did suspect that she might be a witch for a short while, based on my prejudices against her and the fact that I felt she wasn't very nice to me. I mean, so what are some of the tells, some of the ways we can recognise witches?
Yeah, I was just about to, for people who haven't seen this or read the book in a while. So the list of tells for the witches, they always wear gloves, because they have thin, curvy claws like a cat rather than fingernails. They're entirely bald, but they always wear wigs to cover up their baldness. And because of this, they all get a terrible rash on their heads, so they're always scratching their heads. They have large nostrils for smelling children. And if you look in their eyes, the pupils change colour and sort of see fire, and they kind of dance about and this curious coloured effect. They don't have toes, and their spit is blue.
And they use it as ink, which is just so convenient. Can you imagine?
one of the many perks of being a witch.
Yeah.
It did strike me that... hopefully there's been no one who's undergone chemotherapy and then has been accused by a young child of being a witch. It seems like it could have happened.
Yeah.
There was a girl at my school who had like a really severe skin condition on the back of her head. I fully associated it with this, and like, I never actually thought like, oh, she must be a witch, but like, there was a connection of horror to that kind of like bodily thing. And like, you know, that's really unpleasant to remember and realize that, like, yeah, I fell into that othering trap of like, oh, that person's got something weird about their head. They're horrible in some way.
I mean, that's the most troubling aspect, I think, Roald Dahl's writing in general. And, you know, I think there are books he wrote which are more generous. I think Matilda's generally seen as a more generous book, perhaps, or maybe some of the later books, but he definitely likes playing off abjection, right? And the villains being repulsive and repellent, and this obviously being manifesting itself physically, although I guess this is complicated in something like The Twits, where he kind of gives it the caveat that if you have beautiful thoughts and a sunny disposition, then even if you're not conventionally attractive, you'll still look nice. Alex, do you have your book with you?
Yes, I do.
Can you turn to pages 4 in my edition, Blake's drawing of the two women, and one of them's a witch?
Yes.
So I'm going to say 3, 2, 1, and then we'll say left or right and see if we agree on the one that's a witch.
Yeah.
Okay. 3, 2, 1.
Left.
Yes.
Yes.
It's the nostril. It's the nostril.
It's the slightly weird nostril. They are really genuinely unpleasant, those nostrils. But yeah, what, you know, what if someone's just a heavy cocaine user and they just worn out their nostril a bit? Like, there's no reason to judge them and assume they're a witch.
That's very fair.
Yeah, I mean, I think Dahl is sort of somewhat careful about this, in like that he's saying, like, that he kind of stresses that it's not, it's all of these things that means they're a witch. Like, he's like, oh, you know, you have to look for all of these things to show that they're a witch. It's not just one of them. But I mean, it, obviously, people will, particularly kids, will take that and, you know, decide that people are witches just based on things they can't, don't have any control of. But so apparently, yeah, apparently this book was banned from some libraries due to people thinking that it's misogynist. I guess we've touched on that a bit, but I don't know. I'm not quite sure what I think about that.
I think it, weirdly, I think it's more misogynist when it's talking about non-witches than when it's talking about witches. Like, there's quite a few, like, offhand, like, kind of like, oh, of course, all other women are lovely. and kind of just like, there's a slight patronizing tone to when it's talking about like that, like there's really solid, strict gender lines about how people are supposed to be, that's got nothing to do with the witches thing. And it's talking about people other than witches. And that kind of came up about two or three times in a way that was just like, really? But you know, I guess that's, yeah, that's one of the problems with this sort of thing.
Although the grandma is kind of an exception to that rule.
Like incredible Stone Butch grandma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, who isn't, like, you know, villainous like Mrs. Trunchbull in Matilda.
Yeah.
But, you know, is great, is resourceful and loving and hard and soft at the same time. So Dahl was clearly capable of writing fully realised women.
Yeah.
Mm.
And she is kind of brilliant as well. There is just a kind of like matter-of-fact love and abruptness to her that is just, yeah, just really joyful. Like, there's so much affection between her and the narrator. And, yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, I thought, a shame it didn't come across so, quite so much in the film, their relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what complicates it, is that there is the character of the grandma, who's a really great character. I think there maybe is something about women who hate children being unnatural, kind of thing, as we get in Matilda as well with the Trunchbull.
Yeah, what a hypocrite that role, though. He hated children too.
I mean, he obviously hated children. Like, I just want to jump to the bit which is just this, and I would have absolutely adored to be reading the book to kids in a school setting. And get the line about, she might even, and this will make you jump, she might even be your lovely school teacher who is reading these words to you at this very moment. Like, I love that, like, he does, like, this book seems designed to kind of, like, upset and distress in most ways. And that, like, giving your teacher the chance to allude to the fact that they might be a witch is just brilliant. It's really smart kind of setting stuff. Sorry, that's a distraction possibly, but yeah.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I think this book was read to me by a school teacher. So I hope she enjoyed that.
I mean, Barbara Creed in her book, book The Monstrous Feminine, as so famously analyses a lot of horror films, right? It talks about Alien, and asserts that lots of horror is kind of rooted in this idea of the feminine as abject, or the monstrous feminine. So the Grand High Witch in The Witches would combine the figure of the witch with the figure of the archaic mother. Behind the kind of feminine facade is death, basically. You know, is rotting abjection. So literally in the film, when Angelica Houston, you know, takes off this beautiful makeup mask, you know, behind it, she's like a sort of abject, rotting corpse. So I guess you could say this is sort of playing off fears around barrenness, perhaps. I mean, we were talking about the bad women in the book being those who don't like children. So I don't know if horror is situated as women who, aren't motherly and aren't giving birth to kids.
I think there's an aspect of that. It's a trope, isn't it? I don't know, I watched half of Jurassic World before giving up in disgust, but that was, you know, just in that film, you know, there's the, and that, this is a recent film where there's the career woman who doesn't like kids, and she just gets, I don't know, like mauled by a pterodactyl as punishment or something.
It's what happens. That's what happens.
Just pterodactyls employed by the state. To further their patriarchal aims, damn them. Damn their beady eyes.
It is like, it's interesting. It's quite indirect, and then there is the kind of like, this is about kidnapping children as well, obviously, like the hatred of children is a kind of part of it, but like there's this, it's so weird to be talking about like something that, like, I don't know, when I was reading this, you kind of had those kind of like corny, like Stranger Danger kind of videos.
It's easy enough to know who's good and who's bad on the telly. People are not always what they seem to be in real life. You've never met any of these people. How do you know whether they're good or bad? You can't tell by looking at them, and that's why you must say no to strangers.
At the same time as having this book that's telling you that there's women who are going to turn you into mice or dolphins or paintings or something. it's weird because, like, actually there is, like, I mean, I know that maybe this is just me being weird, but like there's a kind of positivity to the places where most of these kids are taken to, like, you know, this idea of being a mouse is still, it's just fun, it's made to seem exciting, like explicitly within about like a page of the narrator being turned into a mouse, he's talking about like how great it is, about how exciting it is, about how fast he can move and all of these kind of things, and oh, there's a few downsides, but no, this is great. And like in the little stories at the beginning, like, you know, the family gets to spend a whole day playing with their porpoise sibling before he disappears, and I don't know, there's so many weird messages going into there that I almost feel like it's trying to encourage you to go and get caught by a witch because you'll probably have a really exciting life.
I don't think it turns out so good, so shall I read the passage with the girl who's trapped in the painting? There was a family called Christiansen. They lived up on Holmen Colin, and they had an old oil painting in the living room, which they were very proud of. The painting showed some ducks in the yard outside a farmhouse. There were no people in the painting, just a flock of ducks in a grassy farmyard and the farmhouse in the background. It was a large painting and rather pretty. Well, one day their daughter Solveig came home from school eating an apple. She said a nice lady had given it to her on the street. The next morning little Solveig was not in her bed. The parents searched everywhere, but they couldn't find her. Then all of a sudden her father shouted, "There she is! There's Solveig, feeding the ducks!" He was pointing at the oil painting, and sure enough, Solveig was in it. She was standing in the farmyard in the act of throwing bread to the ducks out of a basket. The father rushed up to the painting and touched her, but that didn't help. She was simply a part of the painting, just a picture, painted on the canvas. "Did you ever see that painting, Grandmama, with the little girl in it?" "Well, many times," my grandmother said. And the peculiar thing was that little Solveig kept changing her position in the picture. One day, she would actually be inside the farmhouse and you could see her face looking out of the window. Another day, she would be far over to the left with a duck in her arms. "Did you see her moving in the picture, Grandmama?" Nobody did. Whenever she was, whether outside feeding the ducks or inside looking out of the window, she was always motionless, just a figure painted in oils. "It was all very odd," my grandmother said. "Very odd indeed." And what was most odd of all was that as the years went by, she kept growing older in the picture. In 10 years, the small girl had become a young woman. In 30 years, she was middle-aged. Then all at once, 54 years after it all happened, she disappeared from the picture altogether. "You mean she died?" I said. "Who knows?" my grandmother said. "Some very mysterious things go on in the world of witches."
She gets to live out her life in a rural idyll. I don't see the problem.
Like in a John Constable painting.
Yeah, like there's ducks. Yeah, she lives a full life. I've people have worse.
It's like Animal Crossing or something. It's fine.
Yeah, that's one of the ones that actually I think for me actually managed to be bleaker in the film. On rewatching, the image of the little girl staring out of the window of the barn in the painting is that
got me. It's quite haunting.
Yeah. Once I knew that she could move around and feed ducks and like just hang out a bit, like it was fine. But like that image and yeah.
Well, there's another little child in a painting at the hotel in the film, which it seems
Of course.
Which it seems like the witch is thinking about snuffing out with her finger. Yeah.
Suggesting this is a regular tactic with them. So did you want to talk about the hotel? Adam.
Yeah, the hotel to me feels a lot more fully realised in the film than it does in the book. How about you?
It reminded me of the hotel in Paper House.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. It's around the same time. They're both by the sea. I thought it was interesting that we've now watched two films that have sort of slightly bleak seaside English hotels in them.
They're definitely a good site of horror, aren't they? A bleak English seaside hotel.
Yeah, I just watched Jonathan Miller's adaptation of M.R. James's Whistle and I'll Come to You, and one of the BBC's Ghost Stories for Christmas. Mm. And that's all set in an East Anglican hotel on the Suffolk coast with this old academic sort of trudging around the beach and then returning to his hotel and being visited by an entity in the dead of night.
The boy and the grandmother go on a holiday to this hotel, and it turns out that the grand annual meeting of all the witches in England is meeting there and being lectured to by the Grand High Witch.
Oh!
What are the chances?
And Ren, did you notice who was amongst the witches? as one of them.
No?
I'll give you a hint. It's a member of Monty Python.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Michael Palin. Michael Palin was one of the witches.
Oh, I didn't notice that. Oh, good.
I was a bit baffled at the fact that I worried that this is my imagination and I missed it, but it looked to me like they switched the name, like in the book. They are meeting under the auspices of the Royal Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Children, which doesn't exist because it's a national society. Yeah. But in the film, it does appear to be the National Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Children, which seems like a cruel thing to smear, like a quite popular and necessary charity.
Oh, God, we're going to be starting our own Pizzagate.
Oh, God.
Exposé. Yeah.
Oh, God. But yeah, I do agree with you about the I think that the hotel, like, I think that there's something about hotels, they're very visual and recognizable, particularly for horror. Like, you know, there is this, the uniformity of like one room to the next and corridors kind of stretching out into infinity. They've been used so many times that there is a horror in hotels, whereas in the book, like, it's a hotel in Bournemouth, and like the mundanity of that is good and makes it feel real, but like also just Bournemouth, like I just can't get excited about a conference happening in Bournemouth.
I think that's a challenge. I think I should go and attend a conference in Bournemouth and spook it up.
Like, it's interesting. One of the things that I don't think I'd ever registered is that, like, my memories of Roald Dahl books in general, and particularly The Witches, like, feel quite vivid to me and feel like they have that kind of, like, sense of place and location. But actually, he doesn't describe anything. You know, you get so little of anything apart from maybe a bit about the characters and a load of, like, onomatopoeia about whatever is happening at the time. Like, the action is kind of, the action's really vivid, but the actual setting isn't really sketched out at all, which isn't how I remembered it. And I don't know at this point whether that's because I overlaid what I saw in the film over my memory of the book, or whether I did have those really vivid experiences and it was just me filling in the gaps.
Yeah, I'd agree. That's really interesting that the setting feels very much like it's there to stage the action,
yeah,
and to be used, but actually in and of itself, in the book, it's not particularly interesting.
Yeah.
And it is a very short book as well.
Yeah.
Like, the copy that I read is 206 pages in big print with lots of illustrations. Yeah. Like, it's... I feel like I was trying to compare the level of horror between this and The Haunting of Eliza Bell Cray, and I think they may be about equal, but it's so much denser in The Witches, as it's a significantly shorter book.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
And it's very, like action to action to action. Like, I think it's one of the things which makes the film suffer is that there's this kind of like almost episodic structure to the chapters, and like it's just a thing happens and then the next thing happens and then the next thing happens, and apart from the beginning and the end, they're all so rapid and quick fire, and I think that damages the pacing of the film as it tries to keep up with that pace and kind of never quite stops or never quite establishes a tone very clearly.
I think I was thinking about the film. I was like, I think it's better in retrospect than when you're actually watching it.
Yeah.
Like, because now it's like a week since I watched it, and I was like, oh, that was kind of good. And like, I'm remembering like the good set pieces and the puppets.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The things, but actually, when you're watching it, it's often quite clunky, and the pacing feels a bit weird. And
And just very weird additions, like, you know, I guess in some sense it fleshes out the hotel that, you know, that Rowan Atkinson is having an affair with one of the chambermaids, but like it's not in the book, it's not really necessary, it doesn't like it's just yet another thing that we've got to try and pass as we're going through this quite hectic film. But yeah, I guess actually that one of the qualities that makes a good kids film is that it looks better in retrospect, because those are the ones that you remember and really want to like, you know, the way you interact with a lot of kids media isn't through the media itself, it's your memories of it. And yeah, I mean, I guess that's from my perspective as a grown-up, but
it is a film of moments, I think. Yeah. And yeah, of set pieces, like the transformation sequences, are very striking. And grotesque.
I'm just impressed at like first of all, like the mouse puppets are brilliant, but also like the mouse work, you know, the training of those animals, and like getting all of those shots that work and fit with everything, like that must have been impossible. Like I can't imagine it, you know, no one would ever make a film like this now, because you'd just CGI it, you know, you'd just go through to that. And I hate to be one of those like horrible nostalgia fiends, but like There's something about the kind of practicality of it that, like, really, yeah, really shows well in it a lot of the time.
Hmm.
Yeah, it feels embodied, right?
Yeah.
In a way that's pretty satisfying. I certainly didn't like the transformations as a kid.
There's another boy in the hotel called Bruno who gets turned into a mouse. Particularly his transformation is quite awful.
Yeah, that's the one that stuck out to me as especially awful this time round.
Five!
I can't even see any chocolate!
Three,
well, one of these, please, tell
one,
me!
One!
I mean, it's full American Werewolf in London, isn't it? Like, it actually goes for those little physical details in a way that you kind of don't expect it. And, like, I think they possibly spent a lot of their transformation budget on that one and so rushed the rest of them just to kind of, like, get through it. But, yeah, it really makes a mark.
He's also, like, farting and burping out this green gas, which just makes it even more disgusting.
Yeah. I was reading the Wikipedia article. Apparently, which I found quite tantalising, the original cut of the film was scarier. but the director edited out some scenes after, like, guinea-pigging his son. Like, oh, my son's like a crying wreck.
So if only the young boy Rogue had a slightly sturdier stomach, we might have been even more distressed now. I think it's also like, I think it's a bit of a shame, like one of the things that kind of strikes me about transformation in the books that, like, I'm kind of sad that they missed it, although I guess it would make it more of a comedy, is like the first step of the transformation being like jumping into the air and yelling like you've just had a sat on a pin. There's something really vivid and silly, and yeah, I don't know, I liked it. I think that was good in there.
I think Quentin Brake's drawings are at their best of the transformation, especially Bruno. It's great. He looks so wibbly.
So the most iconically horrifying bit in both the book and the film is when the Grand High Witch removes her face, you see, and to reveal her true form. Is the rest of the witches are more or less, you know, they look like people, but they're bald and they don't have toes and so on. But the Grand High Witch is much more monstrous. I'll just read the extract from the book. That face of hers was the most frightful and frightening thing I had ever seen. Just looking at it gave me the shakes all over. It was so crumpled and wizened, so shrunken and shriveled, it looked as though it had been pickled in vinegar. It was a fearsome and ghastly sight. There was something terribly wrong with it, something foul and putrid and decayed. It seemed quite literally to be rotting away at the edges, and in the middle of the face, around the mouth and cheeks, I could see the skin all cankered and worm-eaten, as though maggots were working away in there.
Gross.
All right, don't hold back.
And again, Quentin Blake's picture of it is genuinely quite unpleasant. It's good.
A kind of Italian zombie film image, really corpsey.
Yeah, it's very corpsey.
Well, do you want to talk about Houston's performance quickly? As the Grand High Witch, because she really kind of vamps it up, right?
Mm-hmm. I think she's what everyone remembers from the film. She's sort of slightly German. Actually quite German. I think she's quite German.
Yeah. She's definitely a lot more, I don't think it's explicit that she's German in the book. And in fact, the rolling R's doesn't really make sense for German. So I think it's supposed to be a kind of pan-European monstrosity in the book. Whereas the film goes very German.
So are the witches basically Nazis in the film? Seriously, are they doing that?
I think, given the Roald Dahl being reportedly fairly anti-Semitic in personal correspondence, kind of indicates that it might not be.
Ren is not sure.
Mm. I don't know. I didn't really get that.
Do you like Houston's performance in it?
Yeah, I do. I like how I like the drama she brings to it. Makes the Grand High Witch very performative. And what do you think?
Yeah, I like that she's clearly relishing the role and having a lot of fun with it. And obviously she gets a kind of stage to herself, so she really does get to perform. Did you want to do Texture of the Week?
Sure.
Right.
Don't have any instruments. I've got some rusting paper. I'm going to go first. My texture of the week is when in the book, the Grand High Witch is giving the recipe for the potion to turn all the children into mice. And there's all sort of fantastical ingredients, but you take the wrong end of a telescope and you boil it until it goes soft, and you roast an alarm clock in the oven until it's crisp and tender. Enjoy those textures.
That was going to be mine.
No, sorry.
It's all right, I've got a backup texture.
You both really like crispy alarm clocks.
Just there's something about the fact that it's tender. I think the idea that when you boil an alarm clock, eventually it will be crisp on the outside and but really tender and moist in the middle.
Oh, deep fried really, tofu.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, the whole of the recipe is probably one of my favourite bits that was cut from the film, I think. I can't believe that you'd turn down an opportunity to just go through that kind of stream of odd objects and things. And it's so, so visceral and just these wonderful sounds. And that was, so my other texture of the week as a backup is basically just Roald Dahl's onomatopoeia and made up words and just the willingness to kind of go into it. But particularly when she is, I'm not going to attempt to do the accent, but when she's attempting to She's telling off one of the witches and starts calling it, "You blithering bumpkin," screeched the Grand High Witch. "You brainless bog vumper. Are you not realizing that if you are going around poisoning little children, you will be caught in 5 minutes flat? Never in my life am I hearing such a bosh volloping suggestion coming from a witch." And bosh volloping is definitely the best textured word I've heard. This week, it's wonderful. I just love it. I love the way that I think that's how Eldar's language gets you as a kid, is that like there's just this kind of like this fictional language, and it's just this joy in the idea that you can just make up a word, and if it sounds right and fantastic and true, then it is true while you're listening to it, and you believe in you believe in the things that he's saying. And like, this isn't even one of the books that goes that far in that direction. You know, there's no Vermicious Canids or any of that sort of stuff. But yeah, I don't know. I like the texture of the language and bosh volloping in particular.
Bosh volloping. Adam?
Probably the prosthetic nose of the Grand High Witch.
Ooh, yeah.
That is a great beak-like rubbery nose. Just the rubberiness of the prosthetics in this film. Nigel Booth was responsible for the prosthetic makeup, so I think a shout out to him for doing such a good job.
Yeah. The unpleasantness of the mask, of her mask going back on over that nose and kind of like crushing it back down into place as her face gets wrapped back around her is definitely a strong contender for texture of the week if you're looking for something significantly less pleasant.
It kind of makes me think of the skin mask in Brazil.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's really similar image, isn't it?
Cool. Should we talk about the ending or endings as they get, as this is the biggest divergence between the book and the film?
Yeah.
I want to just, if I can just leap back to the fact that, like, the ending is kind of, like, foretold at the beginning in the book in a weird bit of perspective that I really like, and I mentioned briefly, which is that, like, at the beginning of the second chapter, the narrator points to themselves with their language, like, so... I myself have had two separate encounters with witches before I was 8 years old. From the first, I escaped unharmed, but on the second occasion, I was not so lucky. Things happened to me that would probably make you scream when you read about them. That can't be helped. The truth must be told. The fact that I am still here and able to speak to you, however peculiar I may look, is due entirely to my wonderful grandmother. And I love that. Like, I know that, like, it's really like textbook foreshadowing, but like that, just to drop that in such a wonderful way, and just like, oh, what has happened to this boy? Like, how are they able to talk to me? Like, where does that come from? And like that peculiarity, that really gets me. I think that's really lovely to.
What does he look like?
Yeah. And then does some weird things to the ending in terms of the book, in terms of like when this is situated and like who he's talking to. And like, I always find it's interesting to me that the book presents itself as being read in a book and told by a teacher and told by the main character, like, over a coffee. Like,
do you think, like, perhaps the narrator and his grandma are on a kind of lecture tour of schools, having successfully rid most of the world of witches?
Yeah, I mean, it must be, like, but it's such a short time window. Like, I was worried about whether they'd have time to get rid of all of the witches.
They're really efficient.
Really efficient, like, and it's so odd. Yeah. Like, so, sorry, I'm jumping before you've actually told the story of the ending.
Essentially, in the book, it ends, well, they pull off, in both the book and the film, they pull off this plan to take the mouse-making potion that the witches were going to put into chocolates to sell to children, to turn them into mice, and the boy in his mouse form manages to sneak into the kitchen and pour it into the soup, that the witches are having that evening, and they all turn into mice and get like basically stamped on and exterminated and run away from in the hotel. So boy and his grandmother go home as we've mentioned, to various contraptions rigged up so that the boy can get around the house in his mouse form. And in the book, he one day asks his grandmother how long mice live, and she says, "Oh, maybe another 9 years or so." And he says, "Oh, okay." And he's like, "Do you think you'll live another 9 years?" And she's like, "Yeah, I reckon I could do that."
And just, oh, great! That's nice and simple. Like, it is wonderful that he is just immediately like, "Oh, that's fine. That's brilliant. Nine years, enough time for us to hang out a bit. I wouldn't want to live any longer than you anyway, because you're wonderful." Like, it's super sweet. It's super kind, and there's something super lovely about it. Although I would point out that the grandma was like, "Oh yeah, mice live about 3 years, but you're a human mouse, so I guess about 9 years."
And then they come up with the idea to a plan to go around the world and turn all of the witches in the world into mice, and then release cats to eat them.
Hey, give that back!
Mouse trouble? Then you need Mouse Trap!
Mouse Trap? I guarantee it's the craziest trap you'll ever see!
The first to capture everyone else's mouse is the winner!
Just turn the crank and snap the blank and boot the marble right down the chute. Now watch it roll and hit the pole and knock the ball in the rubber top tub, which hits the man into the pan. The trap is set. Here comes the net!
Ouch!
Mouse Trap? I guarantee it's the craziest trap you'll ever see!
I win!
I knew you were a winner!
Yeah. And then steal their castle, let's not forget. Let's just go and move into the castle. That'll be great.
So that's their plan for the rest of their lives.
Go on this kind of world tour of annihilating every witch in the world.
So this is clearly considered a bit too bizarre or bleak for the film. So, I mean, it's a bizarre, but the ending of the film is more bizarre, really. Is we have the Grand High Witch's secretary, who was banned from the dining room and consequently escaped being turned into a mouse, has a change of heart. This is where this redemption comes in, and turns up at Luke, the boy's called Luke in the film, turns up at his house to turn him back into a human before sort of disappearing off into the sunset. Which is quite unexpected.
Yeah, and a redemption purely motivated by spite at one's boss.
Yeah, yeah. Which is the best form, you know. Like, we must unite and overthrow the bosses. I'm all for the message in principle, but it seems so odd. Like, there's a few hints about the fact that she doesn't get on with the Grand High Witch, and the Grand High Witch is an awful boss to her. And then that's enough to just suddenly, like, yeah, just suddenly yield a like complete turnaround. It's like, oh yeah, no, I'm good now. I'm just going to go and track down those people and turn them back into a human, because obviously that would be great. And it just loses so much of the charm. Like, there's such a kind of like, yeah, like, so I wrote death positivity because apparently whenever I come on, like, that's a thing that comes up in the in the things that we watch. But like, you know, it's really charming, actually, that he says that actually, yeah, no, we love each other. We're really good together. We have a way to work out our way through the world. So I'm quite glad that we're going to die at the same end. So that's a form of death positivity. But also just the kind of like, yeah, like I say, the fact that he's just so happy to be a mouse and so happy to just go about and take advantage of that and adapt the world so that he's able to function in it. And yeah, I don't know, there's something really cheerful about that. And like, you get to look at it as a kid reading it, and it's weirdly, I don't know, I feel like I feel like I would have been really reassured by the fact that I knew that they were off kind of dealing with the witch problem. So actually, this kind of existential dread of all women that I'm supposed to have, I don't have to worry about it because all of the ones in England have been got already, definitely. And I trust these guys to go and deal with the rest of the world as well. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is kind of a reassuring ending in the way, because it's like this really terrible thing has happened to him, but he's all right.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And the film nearly goes for that as well. Like, you know, it has a really sweet, like, him getting up into his, like, Ghostbusters firehouse building and and his weird little Meccano lift and, like, you know, and he's there and that's it. They've just adjusted to that fact. It seems like a good ending, and it seems really odd that just suddenly Jane Horrocks shows up and is like, oh no, it's fine, I'm gonna fix things. I don't know, I just find it odd semantically or in terms of the meaning of it. Like,
apparently both endings were originally planned. They ended up going with the more optimistic endings. Which Roald Dahl was very upset about. Originally wanted his name removed from the credits. So clearly this death positivity was very central to what he was trying to get across. Because apparently he was very upset and angry that that it was altered in that way.
I just think it doesn't actually make the ending more positive. I think that's the thing, is it's so tagged on and it's just one little element that I just don't think it really makes a huge amount of difference. And like, yeah, it just feels quite pointless. Like, you know, I don't know. But then, as we've said, I have quite an odd relationship with this book, and I just wanted to be a mouse when I was little. So who knows? Or an ant. My other option was an ant. So I was really upset when Bruno Jenkins is boiling ants. I do remember that. Like, I did have a sudden flashback to getting really upset reading the book that Bruno Jenkins burnt ants with magnifying glasses, because I was obsessed with ants when I was little. Sorry.
That's brought back an upsetting memory of trying to study an ant under a child's microscope when I was young, and accidentally crushing it.
Oh no!
Half crushing it under the edge of the microscope, and then looking at it under the microscope, and it kind of bucking wildly like a dying horse.
That was when Adam learnt about death.
Yeah, it was very upsetting. Like, very guilty, obviously.
Oh, love, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it's quite a vivid image. Oh. So on that bombshell.
Well, I mean, that's why we do this podcast, to
work through our issues with death.
Yeah. It's just therapy, really.
Cool.
Brilliant.
All right. Thank you very much, Alex, for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
It's been great. Adam.
Oh no, you do no, no, I you do the credits first, don't you?
Oh, I guess I do. Okay, yeah. Our intro music's by Maggie Yamazaki, outro music's by Jay Kelly, artwork's by Letty Wilson. We have all their details in the show notes, and I'll give a link to Alex's stuff as well, so you can check that out. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at StillScaredPod, or email us at stillscaredpodcast@gmail.com.
Or leave us a review on iTunes.
Ooh.
Well, thanks for listening, chat bags and boot bogglers. Have a rotten good night. Bye.
Bye. Thanks, baby kids.